very much organizational, you're right, very much communicational, and the purpose was to mobilize and motivate people. And that's what this whole political Dongshan system consisted of. But it takes a very highly organized structure to counter that. And that really was always the South Vietnamese government's major problem, was simply in getting organized. Particularly after Diem was overthrown, we went through this government by coup d'etat, one government after another. Province chiefs were replaced every 6 months. This created a very unstable administrative structure. Everybody in Vietnam knew that. I mean, you didn't have to know much about this if you had a province chief who was just on the job for a week and then bang, he's off and a new one comes in. So the problem was how really to get organized and to stay organized. It's one thing to say to the Vietnamese, you've got to get organized. They knew this. I mean, you didn't, that wasn't the problem. One of them said, you know, you're talking about juggling. You juggle these five pool balls in the air. And you say, here, you juggle them. And I said, I don't know how. He said, that's it. See? You can see what you're supposed to do. That's very easy. It's how you do it. We think of government as too much, I think, as being Congress and legislative. But what government really is administration. It's bureaucracy in the proper sense of the word, government by bureau. A government that collects the garbage or educates the people, watches over their health, and that is what takes organization. And when it's constantly disorganized, and particularly you have an organizational steamroller out there in the jungle, National Liberation Front, which was highly organized in early days, it's really a wonder to me that the South Vietnamese survived through those early years the way they did. Is in their tenacity and their personality that did it. And sheer determination of stubbornness, if you will. In other words, let me get back. Oh, you, okay.
To what extent was the Phoenix program successful in addressing at least some of the elements of
the strategy? Well, I think the judgment is that it wasn't too successful.
Particularly in the later years.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure how you measure. After these key cavities, what the idea was, British used this in Malaya in a somewhat different form, essentially the same. I mean, they had a smaller problem there. They had a file card of the 3,500 CTs in the country, the leading CTs, communist terrorists, and they had a systematic program from the very start to get them out any way that you could. Bribe their bodyguards, offer them the so-called black bag of gold, anything that they wanted, just get them out. Assassinate them, kill them, run agents in. It cut off the head. This is the theory. It worked fairly well. It lowered the quality of the CT leadership by very drastically. As far as I can tell, this never, and again, I hesitate to say this because I don't know how you really measure it, but as far as is, the Phoenix program, first of all, was part of what they called the census grievance program, which was a broader type of program to get at the motivation and the motivational and the organizational techniques and methods and devices which the bomb program used in the rural area. And assassinating the leaders key cadres was only part of it. I have no doubt that it was subject to misuse. The province chiefs used it to get rid of people that weren't communists, that they just wanted to get rid of for some reason. I think that's the basic danger in the system. I don't think it can be free of excess abuse, but this is more of a feeling I have than anything I can document. I would argue that there is no particular moral argument against this. In my opinion, there's not. I mean, the guys in Hanoi that sent people, a million Vietnamese, down the trail who never came back, they, as leaders, or any of their sub-leaders, are not sacrosanct. Our leaders are not sacrosanct. And no more immoral to kill a private than it is to kill a general, in my opinion. You can't build a moral case, in my opinion, to the contrary. There does seem to be a kind of gentleman's agreement among presidents and leaders that I won't try to kill you and you won't try to kill me, which makes sense from their viewpoint. I'm not sure it makes sense from the rest of us. Fred. There's also we don't have a lot of data on that. It hasn't been written the way it dissertation on the Phoenix program, and then he died, unfortunately, even before he finished it. We've got a copy of that, and I've been after the lawyers as to, and the California University, as to what the legal status of this is. It's a boil down of his dissertation, or a recasting of it, and it's extremely detailed in it's not just the Phoenix program, it's the whole census, which is a whole series of techniques and methods and devices that were used that I don't know anywhere where this is written anywhere else. For example, there is what they call the black tent device, in which they borrowed this from Malaya, in which they went out and set up a tent, or didn't necessarily black, in a village, and then, or a hamlet more likely. Then they would say to every person in the village, you're to go through this tent and have a cup of tea with this fellow inside. And so when he would come in, he would say, is there anything going on in this village that you want us to know about, we Americans? Any corruption, any Viet Cong activity, anything at all that's on your mind? And usually the guys say no. And they say, well, we're going to sit here for 5 minutes, whether you say anything or not, so let's have some tea. And then the person would go out, and another one would come in. And at the end of this, or the next day, or the same day, security people would come in and arrest them. some instances, a district could come down and fire the hamlet chief. Now, often, that knowledge of that, whatever it was, they took into the village with them. They didn't get it from anybody in the village. They knew it outside. Sometimes they got it from inside the village. But what this created, the next time the team came back, was a kind of sense of credibility, a feeling that you could pass on information and be relatively secure as to how that information passed. The census grievance program had dozens of little programs like that. They seem quite plausible when you look at them, but now at a historical level, what we got to do is try to figure out, were these sensible? Did they work? Should they have been used more? Or were they a hokey idea? Or what? And we have not done of that really particularly addressed to the tactics used by the South Vietnamese, particularly in this sector. All the teaching on this seems to have to do with attitude, ideology, communism, Marxism, that explains it. Doesn't explain it at all. I mean, you can't begin to explain the Vietnam War in terms of Marxism-Leninism. I can argue there were no Marxist-Leninists in Vietnam. Not the way there were in Moscow in those days. I wrote the last chapter in Viet Cong. I'd done my undergraduate work, of course, in Soviet studies. And so I was completely immersed in Marxism-Leninism, and I assumed that that was the cement that held the thing together. And in writing Viet Cong that year at MIT, I kept pushing all of this back to the last chapter, thinking I will do it then. And when I got to the last chapter and I began to examine this, the thing just came apart in my hands. There was no Marxist-Leninist quality to any of this, not as based on a Moscow. And I had notes from Viet Cong, Cadres, question answer. You are a member of the party, yes. Tell me, do you believe the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of the class conflict? I don't know what that means, or no, I don't think that's true. About historical determinism, dialectical materialism, no, either I don't know it or I don't understand it, or I know about it, but I don't buy it. So, well, how did you get into the party? You had to pass an exam, didn't you? Yes. The cadre that examined me told me in advance what the questions would be and what the answers would be. And you don't think that's unethical? No, not at all. You do not have to know anything about communism to be a good communist. I don't know how many times I've heard that. Well, now, that means that Marxism, in its sea journey to Asia, underwent a transformation. Back in Moscow, at least in those days, it was quite the opposite. If you mastered Marxism-Leninism, then you're infallible in terms of interpreting history. Because it's all there, and it's all very mechanical, and your only job is to understand the whole process completely, and in that case you will be. So in Vietnam, you had people who were willing to go out and fight and die for communism, but I was then faced with the problem of saying these guys are not communists. And it's a dilemma that has really followed me to this very day. You simply finesse it by saying it was a belief, more religion than anything else. It was like an icon on the wall. They worshipped it. They said they believed it. But they didn't particularly understand it because they said they didn't need to understand it. The point is, there was a vast range of perception there as to what Marxism-Leninism is. And God knows you find that in Saigon and Hanoi today in trying to interpret, I think they've probably given up pretty much, trying to interpret Marx as to what they should do next in terms of reforming the economy. Yeah. On their part.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this is also, this is, you can find roots of this clear back in Vietnamese history. It's not communist or Marxist or Hanoi oriented. Generals all through Vietnam's history have talked about the three armies that you have, your actual army, your hidden army the enemy doesn't know about, and then the secret army that doesn't really exist, but you can convince the enemy that he does exist. That's typical Viet Cong. Yes.
Well, then you see the party more as a means of loyalty to the individual or government rather than a commitment to an ideology or social reform.
Marxism has very little influence in Vietnam, I'd argue. Leninism is a way of organizing society, a way of motivating people, a way of mobilizing resources. It was very powerful. And it was very effective. It was effective everywhere. I mean, it was effective in the Soviet Union. Don't cut it short. It put men into outer space. That system did. So it is a system for organizing society that has much to recommend. Much to recommend. Well, it is not recommended. But nevertheless, Ho Chi Minh, I think, was not a Marxist, but he was very much a Leninist. He saw in this institutional construct means of communicating, mobilizing, motivating that worked very well. So he took all of that and he just finessed the whole Marxist ideology. I don't think he ever understood it. I think he considered it a lot of nonsense. As I would say, most Asians actually consider Marxism. I mean, if you're coming from a Confucian background and you argue as Marxists do, that nothing is inherently unknowable. Basic tenet of Marxism. You can't get a mother's son in Asia to agree with that. I mean, they think it's absurd to say that nothing is inherently unknowable. Everything is unknowable, practically. The world is full of unknowable things. I mean, it's just sheer arrogance or stupidity to think that nothing is inherently unknowable. Yet I've known Vietnamese Marxists who profess to believe that, I mean, as a kind of rote thing. They memorize the slogan. So, and I'm not sure most Americans would believe this. Certainly not in California. Certainly not in Southern California. We've got people there who believe everything is unknowable. Have churches to prove it. They're fun. You know, they're fun to deal with.
And what was just being said, what if the United States had decided to support Obama? Where would you take that?
Well, you'd take Bob Shaplett's Lost Revolution. That was his thesis. I think he more or less went to his grave still believing it. It was my closest friend in Vietnam. We argued this for 20 years. Not so sure now that he wasn't right. I was sure he was wrong at the time. Now I just don't know. You can hypothesize on this, and you can develop a scenario in which this is exactly what happens. And you can write it, and you can't prove it, but nobody can disprove it. You have the practical problem, although I think if it's more than just a what if, is that the context of the times. World War II was over. Europe, East West Europe, was very shaky. The danger of a complete communist takeover in France and all over the continent, Italy, was very real. The Americans cranked up the Marshall Plan and a program to save France. East and West Europe. Now, the French at that time were going back to Indochina. We have come to reclaim our heritage, as Admiral Dargent Lou said as he got off the plane in 1946. Our choice, really, then, and this was a feeling and a sentiment in France that went all across the political board, part Communist Party in France, the French Communist Party, was all for the Viet Minh War. Now, whatever the ideological arguments were, this was for the glory of France that was at stake, and for whatever political or, you know, temporal reasons, they supported it. Therefore, we were obliged, U.S. was obliged to deal with the question that the French were going to perpetuate colonialism, and even though everybody knew it wasn't going to work. It was the one thing I think that was obvious to certainly the British who were leaving India, the Dutch who were leaving Indonesia, the Americans who had already started the process of getting out of the Philippines, only the French, with their impeccable logic, decided to stay. Our choice was either we are, as I used to say to Chaplin, you really mean to tell me that if I'd have been in Washington at the time, I should have said, let France go down the tube. We've got to help this guy Ho Chi Minh out in the jungle. And they would say, Ho Chi who? And this is an unviable argument. You just couldn't have gotten it off the ground. Now, that doesn't mean that the long historical view, historians would have said, yes, indeed, that's what you should have done. It would have been the wise thing. We haven't reached that point yet, I don't think. At least I know of no historian. And Chaplin doesn't really, he argues we could have finessed it, could have backed the French and backed Ho Chi Minh at the same time. It is an interesting... one other thing, if you're interested in this process, write down the book, name of a book called Bring the Jubilee. Can't remember the author, but it's quite well known. And this is what might have been if Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, you know, came almost to the top. And the question is, why didn't it get to the top, capture the high ground, win the Battle of Gettysburg, march on Washington, and the South would have won the war. And in Bring the Jubilee, this is kind of a science fiction thing, it's 1930 in the United States. There's no transcontinental railroad, there's no air travel. The U.S. is a kind of balkanized country along the Mississippi, dozens of little countries all fighting themselves. So this nutty scientist goes back and says, you know, it's all because of the way the Civil War. So he invents this time machine, and he sends this guy back to the Gettysburg, and then his instructions are to shoot, get in the bushes and shoot a couple of the lieutenants or captains that are going up the hill at the bottom of the hill and disorganize them. So the result is that Pickett's charge fails and the South loses the war. But it's the best example, I think, of meticulously going through step by step. Each of these things that you find in the U.S. in 1930 clearly are traceable back to why there is no transcontinental railroad in 1930. Very clear why it isn't. Or why air travel has never gotten, there's traveling in balloons still and so on. But it's a kind of a case history on how to think through. There's also one with fire on the, where's our Japanologist? Fire on the Mountain. It's about supposing the test of the bomb would have failed and we'd have wound up invading Japan. And it's a very meticulous accounting of the ghastly time we have conquering Japan. Seems to me at the end, do get the bomb, and that begins to cut it short. But it's another one of these what might have been. So, Fire on the Mountain, I guess it's called, by an American who was born and raised in Japan. Yeah.
Can I go back to the question of whether the Vietnamese communist is Marxist, Leninist, or Leninist? There's two questions here. Okay. Number one is a number of scholars have called them Stalinist or Leninist.
Okay.
Number two,
yeah, well, I guess partly this is semantical. If you define that as being Stalinist, and then give me a definition of what Stalinism is, I think I could maybe even agree with you they were Stalinists. Many of the institutions that they introduced no doubt have a Marxist cast on them. They also have a Chinese cast. And so then you're thrown back into looking at what the Chinese did, Chinese Marxists, if you will, or, and you say, well, that isn't really Marxism. We'll call it Maoism, which is, then you say, what is Maoism exactly? Well, it's sort of Marxism, but with an Asian spin on it. Immediately, again, you're into this fuzzy definition of what it is. Yeah, everybody knows what Maoism is until you get down to making a list of what the specifics are. And this is, to me, Marxism is essentially a way of interpreting history, and historical phenomena. And it's very valuable in that way. It really moved the world intellectually ahead in the process of whatever else flowed from it. It was a pioneer thinking in the way that Freud was a pioneer thinker and the way that Einstein was a pioneer thinker. That is, he didn't really invent anything. None of them did. No discoveries, but they produced a field theory. It took what a lot of information others had put it together in Newton, I think, is another example. And that's a sort of special kind of genius, and Marx was very much that sort. But that is applicable, I would argue, primarily to a European, Greek, Judaic, Roman civilization. It is not applicable to a Confucian or an Indic or civilization. And therefore, it is much less applicable in terms of intellect in Asia. Leninism, on the other hand, is a way of organizing society. It, in many ways, has much to recommend it. Indeed, it works. And so I don't know. It's, you can prove that the North Vietnamese were Marxists in a way. I just know that when I assumed that when I was writing Viet Cong, that that was what made them tick. And then I discovered, horrible. I still remember that evening in Boston when I'm looking at this notes on this table and saying, this is all bullshit. I mean, none of this, I can't write this, it won't hold up. And I thought I'd just, write it as a sort of Asian brand of Marxism. I had nothing to prove. That's what put me into this great, face-off with Francis Fitzgerald. I just dismissed ideology as being a factor, and she, of course, thinks ideology is everything, and I put all this emphasis on organization, and she thinks that's BS. So it's one of the competing perceptions that we're still stuck with. Anything else? Final thoughts? Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this very much.